out. Julia! She jumps down, smiling. Julia, hey! What on earth?
What are you doing here? Susan, these are friends I met at Stefano's, and they invited me to join their cooking class with a superb chef. This is Chris. He's guiding them to all the best places in Tuscany. This is my friend, Susan. We ran away together.
You'll love that cooking school. I met Gilda. It already smells good in there.
Shall I come back for you?
No, no, Chris said. I have to run back into town anyway. Dinner will be later. Whatever we cook this afternoon reappears, with a lot of good wines to taste. You're all welcome.
Another time. I'd love to, but I'll head home now. My dog, Archie, has been locked inside all day. Bye. Have fun.
Camille finds the delivered groceries by the door. Julia and Susan are still out exploring while she's spent the day in her new studio reading art books. Archie looks in, his head tilted. She lets him out twice. But otherwise, how luxurious, having a silent day to herself. They've been wildly busy making the place theirs. Now, finally, time just to be there. She's never lived in a house that has a history longer than her own life multiplied by 10. All the weddings, funerals, tears, orgasms, baptisms, secret encounters, all the churned emotions and cooking smells, private triumphs and birth cries seeped into the walls. She hopes Grazia's father didn't choke at the kitchen table where she will have her dinner tonight. The house must rest on bedrock reaching down to water and fire. In a box under the stairs, she's found sepia images going back to the beginning of photography. Small men wearing the rough suits they were married and buried in, holding their hats and staring blankly into the future. Brides with drooping bouquets, myopic, pious, dour, but one quite lyrically beautiful leaning on a balustrade. From her spirited look, she must have been in love with the person aiming the camera. But maybe she was just one of those people who looks back at the world with zest. A couple of dead babies, propped up on pillows but with closed eyes, cotton stuffed in their nostrils and nosegays in their little folded hands. One of a beach party. Must have been World War II era. A long table, men in wife-beater undershirts and women in heavy one-piece bathing suits. Rubberized. All raising their glasses, smoking cigarettes. One hefty guy in suspenders makes a V with his fingers, horns, the cuckold sign, over another's head. Grazia's grandparents must be among them, but this party is long over, and who remembers? The photograph Camille loves most is of the front door of Villa Assunta. No one interferes with the image, just the heavy carved door. Who took it? Half open, and a crack of sunlight angles in like, she mused, a spirit. She toyed with painting something from the photos. She loved seeing them and imagining the life in each. The cracked open door. How to paint a door? Carefully, she packs the box and replaces it on the shelf under the stairs. I don't want to paint the past. She knows that.
Julia will be late, Susan announces, setting down a bag of groceries. Much to tell. I saw a heaven of a garden. The countryside around here is sublime. You've got to turn into a landscape painter. Huh, I may. Not those sappy sunflower fields you see in every gallery, but, you know, the heart of this place. And they're everywhere. Paintings waiting to happen.
She tells Camille about meeting Julia, Chris's group, the cooking school, and the duck pasta. Let's surprise her and have dinner ready. Not that she'll be hungry. Maybe she'll go out with Chris. He's about her age, maybe younger. You know, it hardly registered. He's quite attractive. But I think he has one blue eye and one kind of hazel.
The X in Flux. What Colin tries to gloss over but can't is how much he'd prefer working only from home. In London twice a month, 5 days each, he lives at the office. He keeps meaning to look for a studio, but puts it off. He's not sleeping on the reception room sofa, it's not that bad, but in a corner of the former warehouse in a revived East End. When his firm, Arcus Wright, developed a hotel for a Saudi sheik, the client demanded that he see a completed sample room before he signed the contract. The architect on the project, Colin's friend Patrick, designed a luxury room at the end of their office building, complete with a swirly brown and white marble bath the sheik liked. So Colin has a handsome hotel room, a bit spooky, I think, and spa bath to use, with the most comfortable bed I've ever touched. There's a love seat at the end of the bed, and a corner window looking out at the Thames. The drag is no kitchen, though he's tucked a microwave into the minibar alcove. When he's in residence, he stays crouched over his drawing table and computers in his office at the other end of the building. He steps out for dinner, usually with colleagues, then works late, a light hanging over him in the cavernous gloom. We text several times a day, talk after dinner until he falls asleep in the artificial room. On the Fridays he returns, we celebrate. When two people work at home all day, every day, the other person begins to seem like a version of you, or you of him. With the London interruptions, we stay separate, I must, and charged. But I'm not the one doing the flight delays and the trip into the city and the haggard nights in the closed offices. A bit of solitude I revel in, but I feel terrible for him. Last night he was due home by 9, but arrived at 2 a.m. The Florence airport runway is short. In strong winds, planes can't maneuver between the hills. He had to land in Bologna, take a train to Florence, and then a taxi out to the airport where he'd left his car, then home. I was asleep when he got in. He fell into bed, not even showering. He smelled like jet fuel, as if he'd flown home clutching an engine. What happened? I'd already read his text about rerouting to Bologna. Even though I'd been roused from deep sleep, the smell turned my stomach. Metal. Fumes. You don't even want to know. Then he was sacked out. I was awake, curled around him, until the sky began to lighten and I fell asleep. The next moment, Colin was poking my foot, leaning over the bed with a cappuccino. I'm the one who should sleep in. Damn. This was bad, Kit. Because the pilot almost landed in Florence. Then, abruptly, and I mean abruptly, he pulled up again, jerked up, lumbering like a giant turtle trying to fly. Several people screamed. The guy next to me roared, like a sound in a nightmare. I was holding up the armrests to raise the plane. We could feel the G's dragging us down. Then the ass pilot said, "Sorry, folks," in English, though half the people on the plane didn't speak it. "Wind shear," he said. "These things happen, folks." I hate being called folks. I was terrified. Wobbly for 2 hours. You must have been absolutely petrified. When planes fall, the people on them have longer to experience what's happening than we're led to think. Anyone with a shred of imagination has to have flashes of fear when floating along at 35,000 feet. I really hate coffee in bed,
but the gesture is so sweet that I plump the pillows, scooch up, trying to look awake. Colin seems dazed, imagining, I would be, the plane soaring up, over and over. He takes my hand and covers his eyes with it. Damp boy. Colin face. You. Whiskery. Maybe I should open a local office and restore farmhouses for foreigners. Forget this pie-in-the-sky London firm. What do you think?
I think no. No way.
Restoring houses for foreigners may be Colin's worst nightmare. Occasionally, the houses become jewels, but usually the owners either ruin noble buildings with bad contemporary ideas or drive the architect to drink because they've studied and want historic restorations down to the bent, handmade nails. Worst may be the client who sends 100 images of kitchens.
Can we discuss these?
The cappuccino has the same metallic taste that I noticed last night, and a couple of other times recently. I swirl around the foam and don't drink. I didn't drink much at all last night. No hangover. I'm coming down with something. Or was something off? No, not at Aneta's table. Bronchitis season cometh. Colin is saying that Rick, his boss, wants him in London all of November, and after that, we'll re-evaluate assignments. Do we have any zinc? And is that ominous, what Rick said?
Could be. He may need me back full-time. Christ.
Colin flops backward on the bed and tells me about his week. The work for the firm pouring in from Ireland, Dubai, Mallorca. The friends he met for drinks. The dream he had that he was lifted in the claws of an eagle and flown over Tuscany. He has wonderful success at his firm. But we both know what eludes him. He agonizes over all the shared projects. The hospital. The university theater, the private residences of the super rich. I've seen his notebooks teeming with solo designs. Severe, classical, but super modern museums. Stadiums based on ancient amphitheaters. Fantasy racetracks, bookstores, even an ideal library that I would give anything to see built. I can put my fantasies on paper. My poems, though few read them, are full realizations of my vision. His is the real world of bricks and cranes and compromise and quirky clients, an unholy marriage of art and commerce. He must get his chance. I run my fingers through his matted hair. He imitates a tech client who wants an upper-class British club atmosphere in his flat.
Can you tell me, the client said, what is considered good taste?
Colin, to his credit, liked the client, and they spent two mornings looking at books and shelter magazines, with Colin putting tabs on good taste pages and X-marked ones on the worst taste pages. He dozes for a few minutes, and I ease the cup onto my bedside table. Wind cutting around the edges of the house screeches like lost souls at large. In the distance, Leo's two horses neigh, long whinnyings that blend into the wind and carry it onward. When he sleeps, something in Colin that's wound up relaxes, and he looks like he must have at 14, when the openness of childhood still graces the face with innocence, but the coming changes into manhood already are forming. His beautiful lips slightly parted, fringe of eyelashes fluttering once, bald fist unfurling those long fingers drawn by Da Vinci. In the shower, I wash my hair and slather myself with body wash. I sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. My breasts feel tender. I stand under the hot water, uncomprehending, then comprehending. I'm not myself. I'm not right. I'm not pregnant. I couldn't be. Working across the morning while Colin heads out to the Olive Grove, I run through my Margaret papers. Her book, World, Mafia World, gathers dust on my desk. I take it down to the living room, where Fitzy has commandeered my favorite chair. He accommodates me and insinuates himself across the pages. This is risky, Margaret, getting to know the young wives of mafia dons, functionaries, sons, and those affected by them. She set herself up as an English teacher in Catania, stronghold of crime fiefdoms. Through the children, she's invited to celebrations, ceremonies, Sunday dinners. A whole year teaching 6 to 12-year-olds. I'm sure a good teacher. She's popular. The dons, store owners, even one priest have to be fought off politely. She overhears. She subtly questions. She teaches Winnie the Pooh to the youngest, Charlotte's Web to the middle group, and Romeo and Juliet, other victims of warring clans, to the oldest. She is said to have lost her husband in the Vietnam War. She's chaste, living under the name of Mary Merritt. Dark skirt and white blouse, only the pearls to show her class. Writing furiously at night, hiding her notebook in a locked suitcase under the bed. Brava, Margaret. Here's where I envy her. The crusader giving over a chunk of life for a cause. Not the only one, either. The Taste of Terror, an analysis of the tense Red Brigade's years, serves as a preview for the terrorism we're now having to accept as the new normal. The Mafia book, scathing and incriminating, placed Mary Merritt on a watch list so dangerous that she had to return to the U.S. for 2 years. A lucky return, as that's when she wrote her classic, Sun Raining on Blue Flowers. The crusading books give me insight into her trap mind, her toughness. The novels reveal lyric tenderness, love of the natural world, her sadness, and rapier humor. Hands to my breasts. Yes, definitely tender. After lunch at Stefano's, I pushed around my pasta, I tell Colin I need to pick up a couple of things in the pharmacy. He joins Leo for a coffee in the piazza. Two other guys sit down, and out come the cards. I am stunned. Hit with a taser. The swab is a live firecracker in my hand. Pink. Pretty in pink. Stripes. Pink bubblegum. As my mind shuts down, I rub my hand over my flat middle. A someone in there. Kickstarting. Impossible. 24 years of sex, and now? Now? So, when? I know. After Sunday lunch, that mellow September afternoon, we took our green blanket to our hidden lair under the ilex tree, that sweet, grassy dip that hides us from the world. Colin had recovered from one of his London weeks and was joyous and loving and wild. A brown leaf stuck to his back. Pregnant? Never an option. When I was 20 and went in for birth control advice, my doctor told me that I could not get pregnant with such a tipped uterus. At such an angle, he said, no determined sperm could cascade over that ledge. I pictured an open-mouthed salmon trying to leap upstream and forever falling back. Not having to deal with pills and implants and foams and goo was fine with me. I will keep this to myself, until I can think. Never say never. This changes everything. The X plus Y, or X, now in flux. A small boy with a toy sailboat. And Colin. He likes our friends' children, and even has offered for us to keep them so the parents can have a getaway weekend. But he has always maintained that he doesn't want his own. He adored his younger sister when they were small, but she became a social-climbing, shallow, manipulative jerk. Kittens become cats. Our work would be sliced to bits. We'd be tied down. A slender girl in plaid, skipping rope. A willful girl she is. She flashes my mother's smile. My childless friends have much easier lives and more fun. How late am I? I didn't even notice, but it must be 10 days. No period. Now a comma. No falling off the roof, as my mother used to say. Where did that come from? A quiet abortion in Rome? That would be hideous. Like the moles Fitzy mutilates, tangled bloody rags, emerging from some desperate room into winter light, scraped clean, no one to know. D&C, dusting and cleaning, my mother called the procedure. Colin is 40, a mighty age. I am 44. Last gasp, aging eggs. How unappetizing the sulfur smell when the dipped pastel Easter eggs were found weeks later in the bushes. Remember Margaret saying Italian babies are born old? And children don't always turn out well, no matter what you do. The jeweler's son, porky little kid, he looks like a sausage about to burst out of its casing. I've seen him trip his sister, blame her, and get away with it. What if you had Grazia, always stuffing tissues in her pockets, and her obnoxious laugh? That's not nice. Grazia is... Oh, why the hell am I thinking negatively? Our child. A slice of me, a slice of Colin. Oh, baby cakes. The needle on the gauge keeps falling to empty. I'm stalled. Lose a tooth with every child, my mother said. Annunciation? No way. This late miracle. As though this being always floated out there, holding a sparkler in the sky, waiting for her moment. Her? La raccolta, the harvest. Susan looks down from her upstairs window. Why is Grazia banging on the door at 7 a.m.? It's barely light. 4 men behind her unload nets and ladders from a 3-wheeled truck.
Buongiorno, Grazia.
So sorry. I am forgetting to tell you that today we start la raccolta. How do you say it in English? For the olives?
Oh, the harvest. How exciting. May we help?
Of course. Anzia Maria and I will be back at 1 with the pasta. The table is over near Leo's. If you want, join in for pranzo.
The men spread a net around a tree on the upper terrace and lean 2 ladders into the limbs. By mid-morning, they've picked an entire terrace. The crates brim with shiny black and green olives. They pause against the hillside for their break. Robust panini of mortadella stacked between thick hunks of bread. Julia climbs a ladder. Susan picks from the ground, while Camille draws in ink on blue paper from the terrace above. She's walked the groves, marveling at the character of the twisty trees and the ambiguous leaves shifting silver to sage in the slightest wind. Up close, she's not sure she likes them. Some look like tortured, blackened skeletons writhing out of the earth and trying to turn into trees. Some resemble crazed, headless dancers. She wonders why what symbolizes peace looks so tortured. The oldest man, Pierino, must be 85. He leans over her shoulder and, as if reading her mind, says, "A thousand years in the wind and rain." Only he speaks in Italian, and she has no idea what he said. "It is good," he says in English. It's not good, Camille knows, but maybe inking in a million lancet leaves will make it so. Thin as an olive limb himself, he blends with the tree as he straps his picking basket around his waist. If she could capture that. His whole life present at the yearly harvest, his body at one with the ritual of harvest. Probably the same gray sweater and rough pants for a half a century. "At least I can know this bond, even if I can't experience it as he does. What in my life is as primordial? Only Charles. That early sense when we were together that we were one person halved. Cleft for me, the hymn goes, let me have myself in thee." Though the right word was hide, not have. Charles would be all over this. But no, he is not, because he is powder in a resin urn in the back of the hall closet where I stored clothes I left behind. Old windbreaker. What I can do, she realizes, is help with lunch. She folds her materials into her bag and calls out, "Back in a bit." Susan likes the rhythm, the string nets studded with fallen olives, a piercingly blue sky with scudding clouds. Archie gets his paws caught in the netting and is shooed away by Paolo, a jolly giant who doesn't need a ladder. One of the other men, Lucio, sings songs she's never heard. His high, plaintive falsetto voice comes from another era. "This has been going on forever, and without our help at all," Susan thinks. "Hey, Julia, is this what we came for? Did you ever imagine? Aren't our arms going to be sore?" A flush of happiness suffuses her body. "Here I am at the beginning of Mediterranean life. We join this stylized dance." Adrenaline? Whatever the rush, this wash of certainty is real. "I'm on the verge," she thought, "of finding fresh fields. I'm catapulting toward them." Julia leans onto the ladder, hoping the scraggly branches hold. "Grazia says it will take 4 or 5 days. There are lots of olives. I want to pick every one. Then I want to make the most gorgeous salad on earth with new oil." Chris is meeting her in town after the pause. Last night when he dropped her off, he said he had a good idea he'd like to talk about. "Do you think Grazia would mind if we brought Chris and his group to the harvest? I think they would be fascinated." "Let's ask at lunch. We could pour some wine late in the day. That would be fun." Reaching for a high branch, Julia suddenly remembers Lizzie roaring back into her dream, wearing the chenille bathrobe Julia took to the suicide attempt. Soft yellow, supposed to be comforting. Pitiful. She banged on the door of Villa Assunta, shouting, "Let me in! I'm back!" "Of course you'd appear after yesterday, when I was so happy," Julia thought. That must have been when Grazia knocked early this morning. She climbed down the ladder and emptied her basket in the crate. What do they taste like raw, she wondered. She bit into a ripe one. Wretched. Bitter. When everyone gathers at one, Camille brings a tray of cheeses and fruit from the house, plus a lettuce, cucumber, and radish salad, and a plate of cookies. Grazia and her aunt haul out salumi, lasagna, bread, wine, and more fruit. Everyone draws up benches to the weathered table laden with food. The women let the Italians stream over them. Next year, Julia thinks, next year I will be joking with them. Camille thinks, I'll never understand Italian. Susan pieces together snatches. After every morsel of pasta is scraped from the dish, the men rest under a tree. They pass around grappa and swig from the bottle. A few sips, some talk, and then they're quiet. Julia hears a snort from Pierino. Camille, Grazia, and her Aunt Maria stack the dishes. Maria brews espresso in a mocha pot over a butane burner. She takes small plastic cups over to the men as Susan and Julia, ever ardent, begin picking again. As they drive to town late in the afternoon, they realize, like a light switched on, that every man, woman, and child is in the groves. In the piazza, the conversation revolves around olives. The usually bella figura Italians wear rubber boots and shapeless wool that smells of closed trunks and mothballs. Men are too deep at every bar, nipping back espresso or red wine. This phenomenon lasts 3 weeks, until everyone is sick of hearing about yields and even sick of themselves bragging over their own oil, which is, of course, the best. Already, new unfiltered oil is for sale at several shops. Julia buys half-liter bottles at three places. Chris is waiting for her at Bar San Anselmo, which is rowdy with olive pickers. She spots him in a corner and waves her bottles of new oil. "Let's get some bread. I can't wait to taste." Chris admires the brilliant green color. He admires, too, the excited flush on Julia's face and her exuberance over the olive oil. From the counter, Violetta sees what they have and brings over a basket of bread. They linger for 2 hours with a bottle of the house red, slightly sour. Each oil tastes a little different. All over the top excellent. Neither of them can choose a favorite. Chris tried some of his fanciful descriptions, fresh grass and spring wind, a melting emerald at the bottom of a well, Julia laughs at that, Irish moss. They give up trying. He tells Julia about the group's trip to Montalcino this morning. The monks at this ancient abbey still sing the hours, what, 8 times a day? Lauds, Compline, all the times you're supposed to pray. There was no one there but us, and they do this every day. He covered her hand with his. The abbey is just spectacular, pure, austere, and holy. They both look down at their hands. Something shifts. He lifts her fingers and turns them around. You have nice paws. We should go there sometime, the Abbey of Sant'Antimo. Julia tips her head and looks at him. His eyes, ever so subtly different colors. What is your idea that you wanted to talk about? Move this back on track. I can't fall for him. Wade could walk in right now and say, let's go home. And would I go? Chris's cool hand over hers is the first touch she's felt in months. He pours more wine.
I'd like to see if you'd be at all interested in helping me expand the tours I bring here. Tuscany is second nature to me. I'll always come here. But I'm thinking of moving into Friuli as well.
Is that near Venice?
Right. A great area. Great. I know the wines and some of the makers, but I need a man on the ground. That would be you. To search out the best places to stay and eat. Then I might add Sicily. If I can get it together to leave my home business for that much time, I like the travel. Mamma mia. Or do they really say that? I'm flabbergasted. It sounds fantastically interesting to me. A dream. You know, I'm all about reinventing my life here. But this moves beyond anything I've imagined. They talk details and times. Can I just get this out of the way? I divorced 5 years ago. I have a son, Carter, who's studying enology at UC Davis. My former wife kept the house, and I live in a remodeled bunkhouse for workers in the vineyard.
Julia says, oh, okay, you don't have to. It's all cool.
Just one of those growing in different directions things. Italy became more and more important to me, and she always wanted to go to Hawaii. Of course, that's not it, by a long shot. I was across the room from her at a party one night, and I looked at her as though she were a stranger. Buffed, tan, big smile, big hair. I had this wave of sadness smack me because I thought, I don't love her the way she deserves. It was odd. I'd felt politely blank for a long time, kind of neutralized. He doesn't say that sex with her depressed him. She felt like an inflatable doll. I didn't want to feel that way. I wanted to throw myself into my life again. That's when I expanded my business and started these wine-in-context trips. I got a tutor and worked like a dog learning Italian. I missed Carter, my boy, when I traveled, but I didn't miss Megan. We split when he went to college. I guess I was as lost to her as she was to me. Yoga, cardio, tennis. She keeps busy. Fit. Oh, yes, fit. Met some pilot online. Carter's okay. He's with me a lot. I even have dinner with Megan now and then. California civilized.
I wish my divorce, it's still pending, were that way. I won't even email with Wade. That's my former husband. I'm okay now.
She tells him in bare outline about Lizzie's addiction, how it wrecked them inside and out.
Our good life upheaved and fell apart.
What has consumed her for years, for this moment anyway, seems to take place as through the far view in a telescope. Speaking of her family, she is, if not relaxed, then at least calm. She feels a small burst of sympathy for Wade, a highway flare at the scene of an accident.
Work saved me. I've learned everything at Mulberry Press. The books are solid and aesthetic. I'll show you some I brought with me. They're not just here it is recipe and anecdote, but cultural links too, or history, or why the recipe exists.
Now I am thinking of doing a project with Mulberry myself. The work with you would be such a bonus. She smiles.
It would be exhilarating. I'm really excited.
Chris loves the idea of her learning Italian. I can be your wine consultant. Funny she chose those words, solid and aesthetic. That's what she seems to him. Julia arrives at home late, just as Susan and Camille sit down for dinner. She serves herself a bowl of risotto that Susan made with lemon and pistachios. Camille, salad queen, washed extra lettuces this morning when she prepared lunch in the Grove.
We eat unbelievably well, Julia says. Even the simplest thing is incredibly tasty.
Why is everything good?
I think they leave it alone.
Susan dribbles fresh olive oil over the salad. Julia immediately shares her news about possibly researching Friuli for Chris.
Can we go on trips?
Susan, you could visit gardens. Camille could search out the museums and architecture and ruins. I'll find the great places to eat. It will all be good adventure.
Camille proposes starting in Venice before Friuli.
Venice, out of season.
Snow. Does it snow in Piazza San Marco?
Imagine.
Hot chocolate at that cafe where they play the schmaltzy music. Gondolas.
Susan, always up front, interrupts.
What about Chris? He's quite cool, and he seems completely at home in the world.
Are you liking him a lot?
Julia laughs.
A faint tingling in the long-dead extremities?
I think so. What an odd sensation. Sitting in the bar with him, I had an image of us walking down a street together in some Italian city.
Just walking, shoulder to shoulder. And it seemed right.
Would I have an affair at this point?
Why not?
But probably we'll be friends.
She found herself hoping instead for the affair.
A romantic villa hotel with fine linens, a view over a stubbly winter vineyard, and...
She tried to envision Chris in a hotel terry robe running a bath in a big marble tub, but she laughs instead.
I lived with this grinding pain like a dentist's drill constantly in my head. You can't think of anything else with a drill running. That's gone. The relief is hard to describe. The noise has stopped. For now, anyway.
Today, I even felt a slight forgiven toward Wade. Still a there stands Jackson like a stone wall toward Lizzie, though.
She ripped her life and ours, Julia thinks. No words can get at the pity and betrayal and violence. And if my head is a handful of shards, hers must be ground to dust.
You're moving forward now. It's all good.
Susan clears the table. Camille pauses with the last of her wine, and Julia looks at their reflections shimmering in the window.
Yes, all good. Thanks to you two.
Susan brought home from town three new garden books. Camille builds a fire in the living room. After Susan brews a pot of orange-scented tea, the three of them settle for the evening with their books. Camille is reading Elena Ferrante in English, with the original Italian version beside her. Every now and then she reads a few sentences in Italian, her lips forming the difficult sentence constructions. Julia goes upstairs to give herself a manicure, though olive picking surely will stain her coral nails again tomorrow. Chris will bring his group for a couple of hours. He offered to provide good prosecco. Soon new oil will anoint everything. Julia thinks, the years of not looking forward. Now, what luck!
Susan tosses another log on the fire and passes a book to Camille. Look at this garden, La Foce. Let's go there. They're open on Wednesdays.
Camille thumbs through the pages.
That's the home of Iris Origo. She wrote a strong memoir, War in the Val d'Orcia. I'm ready.
Green. Colin is up early, at his desk, facing 1,000 items to verify on the hotel project in Florence. From the design vantage, he's finished, but he must check on the builder's progress tomorrow.
We'll go together,
and I'll walk around town and visit the Strozzi Museum while he works, and then we'll have a free evening for a dinner along the Arno and our favorite hotel. Time for the big reveal. I feel that I have two heads, and no one notices. How can he not know? Well, I didn't know either. Strange that Camille noticed something. Yesterday we walked over to Villa Assunta to see how the olive harvest was going. We have only 50 trees, so we were done, thank God. The olives already taken to the mill by Fabio, who helps us. Tomorrow we'll pick up our 50 liters, more or less, and be set for the year. Julia's new friends were imbibing and toasting. Chris seemed smitten with Julia, following her movements with dog-like attention. She spread her glory around all of us, but I did notice her hand linger on his sleeve when she handed him a glass. She's a bright light, and obviously he's into her. I wonder if she is surprised. Colin met everyone for the first time. I'm not sure he knew which women were at the villa and which were with Chris. Camille was next to me at the table, and as everyone toasted, she leaned close and said, "You all right? Would you like some Prosecco?" "Yes, I'm great. I'm fine with water." "You look pale. I don't know you well, of course, but you look, not yourself." "I'm absolutely fine. Maybe a bit bushed from the olive picking. Thank you for the concern, though." I wanted to grab her arm and say, "What the hell should I do?" Or lean into her shoulder and weep. But she doesn't know me or Colin. Instead, I told everyone about what happens at the mill and how healthy the new oil is when it's fresh. A whole murmuration of women, enthusiastic about Italy, overflowing with a zeal I recognize and still feel in quick flares, although not for the olive harvest. It's fun to dabble for a couple of mornings and to enjoy the camaraderie, but if you're responsible, it's damned hard work, hour after hour with your arms up, your face sometimes whipped by wind. Even with our quick raccolta, my fingers are stiff. I was very careful on the ladder. Baby on board. Unlike most visitors, Susan has fallen hard for this late October ritual. She stayed out all day and will go with the men to the mill to watch the whole process. Grazia has given her a giant plastic container for a supply of house oil, and Julia bought glass bottles to transfer the oil into as soon as they have it. Camille wonders if she possibly can capture that particular green on paper. It's limpid. Not really the color of anything else. Not celery, kale, not asparagus. It's not like a green light, or a Coca-Cola bottle, or moss. Oh, maybe close to a dollar bill? Because I know that everyone loves poetry, even if they don't think so. I raised a toast with my cup of water and misquoted a bit of Garcia Lorca, who knew something about the virescent color. Green. How I want you, green. Green wind, green branches. Big hoarfrost stars come with the fish of shadow that opens the road of dawn. The olive tree rubs its wind with the sandpaper of its branches. My friend, where is she? Tell me, where is your bitter girl? Who will come, and from where? Green, how I want you, green. Colin looked at me with a frown. He knows the poem I've mangled. Lorca didn't even write olive tree. His tree was fig. He smiled, shaking his head. "That's my girl. Now we know what green is." Everyone clapped, and the Prosecco went around again. As we walked uphill, Colin threw his arm around me and nuzzled my neck. What solace. His natural-born tropical scent.
What's up, poetry girl? Something bothering you? You seemed emotional when you were holding forth with the green poem.
There's something to talk about, yes. How did he pick up some trouble ion from my quote? I should know your sharp radar by now. Later we'll talk, okay?
Whatever you want to say, I'm always listening.
I couldn't say, oh, nothing to stress about, since I don't know that. He may totally freak. I'm worried. But then, I always am.
Don't be a worrywart, my mother used to admonish me.
How can you not? Many awful things happen. Will he be stony and accepting? I know him perfectly, down to his curved-in little toe that looks like a tiny shrimp.
Worry, from the old English, worgen, strangle.
It's not that serious, is it? Whatever he says, whatever he wants, whatever he doesn't say, he always will remember this breaking news. In Florence, leaning on the Santa Trinita Bridge, watching the jagged palazzo reflections in the Arno at dawn. Over dessert, at our favorite trattoria, where we ordered fried calamari the first night we met. Knee to knee, on the train, with the autumn countryside speeding by. The Unexpected Garden.
We have a year. More, if we want.
Are you just flabbergasted, as I am, that we get to do this?
Susan speeds into the dips and curves toward La Foce, overtaking tractors on the narrow road with a friendly wave of her hand. They have an appointment at 11, confirmed by the daughter of Iris Origo, to see the writer's garden. Susan, if they get there, will lap up every square inch of the elegant plan. Italian gardens, based on pots and geometry and pergolas and water features, are a new concept for her, totally upending her English-oriented ideas of garden rooms and high-maintenance perennial borders, so casual in appearance but beastly to maintain. They're driving into the barren Val d'Orcia, a vast expanse of undulating hills relieved by cypress-lined roads, strips of feathery poplar windbreaks, fields of plowed brown earth patchworked with other fields of crushed brown sunflower stalks and cover crops of clover. A landscape of subtraction, but still inviting. She swerves off the road.
Let's get out. Camille, you should have an easel. Look at this.
I'm not up to painting a landscape this grand. I should stick with my still lifes. Maybe I could manage that white road down there, the one bordered by cypresses.
Tuscany is beginning to seem like one big garden, Julia says.
Susan is enchanted with the bones of the autumn garden. Formal boxwood hedges and borders are planted extensively, but the garden is not rigid. The young English guide points out what's not here right now. The peonies, allium, roses, and, of course, the wisteria the garden is famous for.
What I like best in gardens, Susan says, is all over this place. The element of surprise. Step through the opening in the hedge, and there's a fountain or a statue. Look, campanula creeping into the cracks of a stone wall, and little sedums popping up on porous stone steps. Low stone basins tucked in the beds hold tiny water lilies, homes for frogs.
That's the way you dress, Camille observed. Very cropped, or angular, but with unusual patterns or accessories, like right now. They paused to notice Susan's long mustard sweater over tan tights, a red, gold, and green scarf knotted just so, and her slouchy red shoulder bag. I'd never think of that acid yellow with red, and it looks fabulous. At first, Camille had feared Susan might be too aggressive for her. She's come to see that quality instead as verve. And Susan always pushes them into the new. Susan gives Camille a quick hug. You're a darling. She takes out her new notebook, scrawling "The Unexpected Garden" on the cover.
I'm glad I brought my good camera.
100 photos later, before they leave, she asks the young guide, Nella, to take a picture of the three of them under a pomegranate tree. They pose with the ancient fruit of Persephone dangling around them, ruddy orange globes, mythic and luscious. A shaft of sunlight through the tree turns Susan's spiky hair into an iridescent halo. In the photo, she will look electrified, if not holy. Julia is caught, about to speak, her mouth half open. Camille's face is shadowed, but she smiles widely and her eyes catch the light.
Are you sisters? Nella asks.
Almost, Camille answers.
What's the Italian word for pomegranate? Julia asks.
Melograna.
A word I love, Nella says.
Pick a couple to take with you.
If you open them underwater, you can get the seeds out easily.
They look pretty scattered over desserts.
Julia nods yes.
You must be a cook.
Where should we eat?
Nella mentions several nearby favorites.
We'll be back in the spring.
I can't wait.
She's already thinking of Chris. He should add this detour to his days in the Brunello vineyards. They find Nella's favorite restaurant in a stand of oak trees. Just inside, a woman is making gnocchi. Julia asks if it's okay to take a video. The woman then exaggerates all her gestures as she forms thin ropes of dough. Italians are born actors. She arranges the small knuckles of pasta on a sheet pan, wipes her hands on her apron, and gestures to the finished pasta.
Ecco!
Here it is. Julia shows them the video at lunch.
Food Network, come crying, she says.
As she reviews Susan's still photos, she realizes that all those real estate years gave Susan a lot of experience.
Your pictures are better than mine, she exclaims.
I have a great idea. Would you work with me on styling and photographing the food for my book?
That would be wonderful. I'd love that.
In a few minutes, they are eating the lightest gnocchi ever made. It can be like rubber bands, but this is paradigm, served with a savory tomato sauce. Simple, yes, as is the salad of small greens with only a drizzle of new oil. Ever get the feeling that we overcomplicate our lives? Susan asks. Camille offers to drive home, insists, really. Susan sits in the back seat, looking at her photos and writing down ideas. A path along the terrace behind the house, a path so narrow that your legs will brush through catmint, lavender, run wild spearmint, and cosmos. Where the terrace turns, a bench. We need secret places in the garden. Plans fly faster than her pen. Camille is humming, and Julia has fallen asleep, her head cranked hard to the right. She's going to feel that later. Growing transparent. New leaf, indeed. When I printed those words on the frontispiece of my notebook, what did I know? I'm in town early because, well, can I sleep? I look through the pages, searching for inspiration for the coming up day. Violetta brings over a ciambella, a donut, with my cappuccino. A sugar rush might be just the thing. Colin snoozes away through anything. Otherwise, he would have been kept awake all night by my churning. Scared and shocked am I. In the night, I was thinking of my mother. Those 4 years I stayed home to take care of her. Her decline.